Today's Tesho will be on Case 36 in the Book of Serenity. Case 36 is entitled, Master Ma is Unwell. Introduction. Even investigating beyond mind, intellect, and consciousness, there is still this. Even studying in ordinary and holy paths, it's already too exalted. The red-hot furnace spurts out iron barbs. With tongue sword and lip spear, it's hard to open the mouth. Without running afoul of the point, please try to bring it up. Case, Master Ma was unwell. The monastery superintendent asked, Master, how is your venerable self these days? The great teacher said, Sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha. Verse, Sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha. Stars fall, thunder rolls. The mirror faces forms without subjectivity. The pearl in a bowl rolls all by itself. If you don't see, before the hammer, gold refined 100 times, under the scissors, silk from 1 loom. So this is day 2 of our August 2008 session. 2009. Oops. And it doesn't matter. And I want to thank everybody for doing a wonderful job, and also for staying. This is day 2, and it's possible that people have had a thought in the morning, like, but my car is right over there. I could jump in and drive away. But please don't listen to that voice. In a little while, everything will be much easier. People come to Sesshin for all kinds of reasons. I suppose that there's a part of us that wants to become enlightened, So we think, if I practice the way of Zen and I go to Sesshin, I can achieve enlightenment. And in fact, many books talk about Zen practice in these ways. And so it's really natural for humans to think in those terms. But what really happens in Zen is rather different. Day 1, people come here and they have a lot of obstacles still troubling them. So, usually on day 1 you might have had some incident at work before you left, and you're still arguing with your boss in your mind, or possibly you have a problem with a parent who doesn't understand you. And you come to Sesshin, and all day long, day 1, this can be bothering you, and you can try to push it aside and get to your meditation practice, And you can be thinking, I've got to get in the groove, I've got to do this, I've got to do that. And then day 2 comes, and it's like a completely different world, Because during day 1, you might have had these problems haunting you, and you also might have had all of these aspirations, right? Like, I'm going to have a Kensho experience at this Sesshin, or maybe I'll even have Daikensho, And you might have had various kinds of ideas about what that would be like. But today, probably when you got up you were a little tired, and maybe you had more pain in your legs than yesterday. And now everything has changed, right? It's probably the case that many of your problems seem from home seem quite remote. At the same time, your aspirations for enlightenment also might seem very remote right now. The most important thing is simply surviving, right? Simply surviving. It's like getting through those three morning sits is such a challenge. We have an hour and a half of meditation with only very brief breaks in between. It's quite a challenge. In many places, people might have a 45-minute sit, and then they might do at least 15 minutes of walking, and then another sit, a little bit shorter. But, you know, we have this very long period of meditation in the morning, and it wears you down. You know? By now, you know, you might just be hanging on by the skin of your teeth, we say. But this is really a very good thing. You know, very good. Because we live too much in the small mind. And when we come to sesshin, we sort of like exhaust the small mind. And at some point, the big mind takes over. And if this probably hasn't happened to you yet, but it really will happen. Maybe around day three, or sometime tonight, you're just going to be feeling better and you won't know why. And life is going to get very simple. You know, it's just like, if I can get through the next 25 minutes, one breath at a time, that's like winning the New Jersey lottery. Right? It's just a wonderful thing. When you sit down to eat, you know, you're going to eat some delicious brown rice and a few vegetables or some dal, and it will be like heavenly nectar, you know. And when you sit down on the cushion, you might not answer your koan, but you won't be bothered by this. You might actually be like happy. And if any of these things happens, it means you're having a taste of big mind. And this mind is really wonderful. You know, it doesn't pick and choose. It doesn't have likes and dislikes. And this is what Zen is all about. You know, living in this big mind. Master Ma in this is Matsu was the really one of the great geniuses in Zen history. After him, we get many, many great Zen teachers. So we get Nansen and Joshu. We get Wangbo. We get Baijiang. We get Linji. All of them come from him. And he was really a very innovative teacher, really like great genius. And in this koan, when he was sick, somebody came to see him and said, "How are you today?" And he says, "Sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha." And this is like a beautiful expression of the big mind. You know, the ideal is to be able to sit without pain. And occasionally, you will have sits with no pain. And it's really fantastic, right? You sit down on the cushion, and it's like you sail through the sit and there's no pain. And that is just amazing and wonderful. That happened to somebody yesterday. The person just thought, no pain. This is great. Today, pain. Right? And you might have a sit toward the end of the day where you feel invulnerable, your mind is steady as a rock, no pain, and you go to sleep and you get up the next day and you sit down on the cushion, it's like, oh, ouch! No. And the whole time it's like a toothache in your knee. This is like sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha. You know, Matsu didn't say sun-faced Buddha and sometimes it's the devil's face. Right? He didn't say that. He didn't say good and evil. He said good and good, different kinds of good. This is really quite different. Now, this is big mind. Little mind says, I have to enter my koan, and I'm worried about it. And big mind doesn't care. And it's not that it doesn't care because it's detached and indifferent. It doesn't care because it's connected to all of this life that's unfolding everywhere around us. And it's just too big to care, see? It's really beautiful. Sometimes when we sit down on the cushion, you know, everything falls away, our concerns, our fears, and you might hear the beautiful sound of the cicadas outside or the wind, and it feels like your own life, right? Or the thunder is just this beautiful, it's like your own thunder, you know. This is a bigger mind, right? And in this mind, you know, you're going to die, you know. It's possible to be very upset and unhappy about that, or it's possible to respond the way Matsu did, you know, just to say, look, sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha. Everything is constantly changing, but it's constantly Buddha. Yesterday I read the beautiful Essential Rules for the Zen Community by Zhang. And remember, he says, the Zen community flourishes by having no mundane concerns. That's like day one of Sesshin, right? We still have mundane concerns. Cultivation of practice becomes solid and secure through mindfulness of Buddha. So I wanted to read... he has a little bit more that's attached to that. It says, by mindfulness of Buddha, we do not seek to be free from sickness. If the body were without sickness, then cravings and desires would easily arise. In dealing with the world, we do not seek to have no difficulties. If the world were without difficulties, then arrogance and sloth would surely arise. In investigating mind, we do not seek to be free of obstructions. If the mind were without obstructions, then we would overstep the proper stages in our studies. In our conduct, we do not seek to have no delusions. If our conduct were without delusion, then our vows would not be firm. In making plans for things, we do not seek success. If we have easy success in affairs, then the will stays slack and proud. When we form relationships with people, we do not seek to benefit ourselves. If we form relationships for self-aggrandizement, this damages our morality. We do not seek to have other people accommodate us. If other people accommodate us, our hearts are sure to grow coarse. When we practice generosity, we do not expect a reward. If we expect to be rewarded for meritorious deeds, then we have ulterior motives. When we see something beneficial, we do not seek to profit from it. If we seek to profit from what is beneficial, the mind of ignorance is active. When we are oppressed, we do not seek speedy vindication. If we seek speedy vindication, then animosity and resentment increase. Thus, when the sages established their teachings, they considered sickness and suffering as medicines, troubles and difficulties as freedom and ease, obstacles and barriers as liberation, and the multitude of delusions as the companions to reality. They consider being bogged down in difficulties as success, broken relationships as sustenance, disagreeable people as gardens and forests, and the merit of generosity as worn-out shoes. They considered keeping away from profit as riches and suffering oppression as a method of practice. Thus, dwelling amidst obstacles nevertheless brings a way through them, and seeking a way through them, on the contrary, brings obstructions. Thus, the Tathagata, the Buddha, attained the path of enlightenment amid obstacles and obstructions. The likes of the murderer Angulimalaya and the renegade Devadatta came to do him harm, but our Buddha gave them predictions of salvation and transformed them so that they became enlightened. It is not the case that for those who follow Buddha's example, when others go against us, it is really favorable to us, and that when others try to damage us, it really helps it. Sorry. Is it not the case that for those who truly follow Buddha's example, when others go against us, it is really favorable to us, and that when others try to damage us, it really helps us succeed? But at the present time, if conventional worldly people studying the path do not first dwell amidst obstacles, then when obstacles do arrive, they will not be able to push them aside. Thus, the great jewel of the Dharma King will be lost. Is this not lamentable? This is wonderful, don't you think? Ordinary way of living is all about freeing ourselves from pain, inconvenience, bad opinion of others, and so on and so on. And it's possible, in fact it's almost inevitable, that people will practice Zen in that spirit, right? But, you know, as soon as you try to liberate yourself from your obstacles, as Bai Zhang says, it becomes creates obstacles. It creates like a split world. It cuts your world in two. So, you know, when we sit on the cushion, it's a sad fact, but if you could just sit down on the cushion and have had no pain, you would never wake up. You would never wake up. It would never happen. But when we have pain on the cushion, you know, this is like great opportunity. Somebody came in to see me in Dokusan. I don't think this person will mind my mentioning this. And the person said, I had very poor sits yesterday until the end of the day when my knees really hurt. And then, when my knees really hurt, I got very deep. And I had wonderful, beautiful sits. It's not just that the pain is like a strategic advantage. That's not the point. The point is that this person stopped discriminating. I mean, encountering the pain, this person responded by no longer discriminating. And the world for this person became more complete, more whole. And the result of this was like deep practice, deep practice. When we're working with a koan, you know, we might be troubled by all the obstacles that seem to arise. So, you know, if I give you a koan, you might be troubled by the fact that you can't answer the koan. Or maybe you're troubled because you can't even focus on the koan. You know, maybe I give you a koan and all you can think about is the argument you had with your boss. Or all you can think about is some personal difficulty. And it seems you can never even get to the koan. But you know, when you are in that mindset where you feel that you're being blocked or you feel that you're being obstructed, you're really cutting the world in two. You know, so often when people are working with their koans, they don't realize that the answer is leaping up before them, but they can't see it because they're trying to resolve the koan. I hope that makes some sense. But sometimes when we're working with a koan and we can't answer it because of all these obstacles that we keep pushing aside as irrelevant, we're really pushing aside the answer to the koan. You know, actually, koans can't be answered. The koan isn't like a question that has a right or wrong answer. The koan is really asking us to experience a greater wholeness, like a greater wholeness. You know, the mind thinks in terms of good and bad, right and wrong, pleasure and pain. And we always prefer one of those. You know, we prefer the pleasure, we prefer what's right, we want to be respected, not thought poorly of. So, you know, but actually these two things always go together. I mean, you really can't have pleasure without pain. It's not a sad fact of life, it's the nature of reality. You can't have, you can't experience freedom without experiencing obstacles. You know. So the point is, you know, when you work with koans, what really has to happen is that you have to be able to experience the world in a bigger way. You know, this is what happened to this person last night. You know, perhaps this person came to Sesshin thinking he wanted to have deep sitting. And all afternoon trying to have deep sitting and thinking of this and that. And then you have pain in your legs and you think, oh, I'll never be able to sit well now because I'm having this stupid pain in my legs. But actually, you know, his answer, his solution to this problem, and he didn't consciously do it, but let go of everything and just be one with all of this that's happening right now. And that is the answer to the koan. You know, that was the answer to that koan. It's like we keep moving in Zen from one world to the next, and it gets bigger and bigger and bigger. But the only way to do this is by encountering the limitations of each of the worlds we encounter. Yeah? And so we always are facing obstacles or barriers, and the impulse is to want to take them away, want to make them disappear. We want to choose this but not this. When what we really have to do is enter like a bigger frame, bigger frame. It took me a long time to understand this, you know. I was raised to be like a good student. And I used to want very much to be the best student in every class I took. And I worked really hard. Like, when I was in high school, I would be studying till I get home, I'd have a snack, I'd start studying, and I would eat dinner with my family, and I would go upstairs and do my calculus or do my chemistry, and in every one of my classes, I wanted to be the best. You know, when I was in 10th grade biology, I was the best student in class, and in fact, my teacher, Mr. Doggins, created like a quiz contest. And on one side was me, and on the other side was the rest of the class. Really? I swear this happened, and guess I won. I beat them to a pulp. You know? Really? You know? That was my heaven, right, at the time. I worked so hard to make that happen. I mean, they all went home and watched The Tube, and I really studied my textbook, you know, I studied and studied and studied. And I wanted to be like a top student, and at the end of each year in high school I would get a trophy for being the top student. And I would go home and my mother would say, "Oh, you're such a good boy." She'd put these up and she kept them right in the living room. People would come into the living room and there were the trophies, you know. Really. And she was so proud. "I'm so proud of you, you're such a good boy." And she was hoping I would turn all this into a professional choice of medical school, which I didn't do. But the thing is, you know, that was a wonderful experience in a certain way, but it was really a big trap, you know, it was a huge trap. Because my world was very, very small, you know. Now, I'm not saying I shouldn't have opened my chemistry book or I shouldn't have studied biology, but I made my world very, very small, you know. And sometimes when I would not get an A, I would be like ill. Really, this is like mental illness, right? So when I would get like a B on like a calculus test, I would really be upset the whole weekend, you know. And that's like, I've got to try hard, I've got to try. Doing Zen was the best thing that ever happened to me. I mean, some people would say it's the worst thing that ever happened to me. But I would say it's the best thing that ever happened to me. Because it really liberated me from that mind. That mind helped me in a lot of ways, I must admit. Having that kind of discipline and that kind of self-control was hugely important. And indeed, in Zen too, we value self-discipline and control and so on. But nevertheless, you know, that way of life for me was really like a trap. And I had very low tolerance for uncertainty, you know. And, when I got to college, for a long time, I was very careful to take courses that I knew I could do well in. But later I began to realize this was not necessarily a good thing, and I began to experiment. I began to branch out and study other fields, you know, where I didn't always get an A. But it wasn't until I got into Zen that I realized how beautiful it is to fail. Now, if you were in school, I'm not saying you should fail your next test, you know. But so many good things come from failing, you know, from being lost, from being trapped. I was reading this article just the other day about a guy who was trying to work on an insulin substitute. He was a research scientist. And he had spent years and years working on this insulin substitute, and it didn't work, you know. So he had spent like 5 or 6 years on this project and gotten millions and millions of dollars, and it didn't work, you know. And yet, you know, he was talking about how he learned so much from that failure. And he went on to do something else. You know, he was working on a certain research project. He realized it might have other applications. And then when he tried those, it really worked, you know. And I've seen this process many times in life, you know. My brother-in-law is a sculptor. And if you ever want to see his stuff, you can go out online. And his name is John Suttman. And if you type in John Suttman, you'll see his amazing furniture. He wanted to be a sculptor, you know. And he got out of school with a studio arts degree and started doing these sculptures. But he couldn't... He couldn't break into, public attention for his art, you know. He would have shows and they wouldn't get reviewed, and he really couldn't make it as an independent artist. So, accidentally, he started doing furniture, you know, like tables made out of metal. And if you go online, you'll see they're amazing furniture, you know. They look like they're made out of wood, and the furniture looks like it's alive. It looks like it might be a chest of drawers, but it's bending like a body would bend to the right or to the left. It looks like a chest of drawers in a cartoon that was designed by Walt Disney, you know. And you would think these drawers couldn't possibly work, but all the drawers work, the doors close, you know. He sells this stuff for a lot of money. You know, it takes him a long time to make them. But the point is, there's lots of millionaires out there who want one of his, or there's some millionaires, who want his furniture. Now, he didn't start out wanting to design furniture. He wanted to do something else. And he was very unhappy early in his life because things just weren't coming together for him. And on the spur of the moment, he started making metal furniture, and at first it was very predictable. You know, metal chairs, metal tables with glass top. But little by little, he began to explore the variations in the form of the table, the chest. He began to play around. So his things are actually made of metal, but they look like they're made of wood. Some of them are quite heavy and they look so light and airy. It's like amazing furniture. You think to yourself, I never even imagined furniture could be like this. Well, this is somebody who encountered obstacles and then went through this process of change. It's like his world got bigger, right? He realized furniture can be a kind of a sculpture. And of course now, because of his furniture, people want his statues, you know. So it was like a very winding road, and he's not where he thought he would be. But he's done beautiful stuff. His life has been a beautiful life. And he's been highly creative. You know, and this is like Zen. This is very Zen, you know. He doesn't sit, but he has the right idea, you know. I mean, when we encounter obstacles, what we want to do is break the door down. Right? We want it to be the way we expected it to be. You know, the ideal is I'll give you the koan, you'll go sit down on the cushion, the answer will pop up, you'll come in, and I'll go, fantastic, you know, wonderful. And then, here's another koan. Then you can go back, answer that, come back, oh, great, wonderful. Right? Next koan, my God, you're answering two koans a day, that's fantastic. But what good would that do? What good would that do? Sometimes you're stuck. You work for 4 months, 5 months, a year on a koan, and you could think, "Oh my God, I'm getting older. You know, I'm not answering my koan. Everybody's answering the koans ahead of me." You might meet somebody who says, "I've answered all the koans in the Momokan, and now I'm moving on to the other collection, you know. I'm almost done," right? You'll meet such people in the world of Zen. Please understand that there's no point in answering koans that way. Right? I mean, maybe they're deeply awake, but it is possible to sort of answer koans in a very shallow way. But, you know, actually, once you're through all the koans, you're really in trouble, right? I mean, because if you haven't really wakened up and you're not really deeply awake, and you're out of koans, now what do? You know? So it's better to be stuck for a year on a koan and really make a deep transformation in your experience than to pass these koans of one after another. I must tell you the truth. I only did about 7 koans before I had my Daikensho experience. And after that, it was very easy to do all the koans, you know. I would do like one a week, you know, or one every couple of weeks. And in fact, you know, my teacher said, "We don't have to do any more koans. You can figure this out for yourself," you know. So answering koans isn't the point. And having done all the koans in the Momonkan isn't the point. And if you meet people who have been practicing for 10 years and they've finished all the koans, that's not an achievement necessarily. What is an achievement is a constantly expanding your view, your experience of life. So every time we do a sesshin, we encounter things we're afraid of, things we hate, things that knock us flat on our ass and make us crushed. And if we can find a way to embrace a bigger world, you know, then it's like what a beautiful path, you know. And so nothing is better really than being stuck or being trapped or being caught. And this is really what Baijiang is saying. You know, it's a false idea of practice to think that we're trying to overcome our obstacles. I mean, I say that myself. But everything is Buddha. So how can this be? See, how can this be? Everything is Buddha. How can this be? So, you know, when you're sitting on the cushion and you're trying to answer your koan and something's coming up, normally we have this reaction like, "Oh, that shouldn't be coming up. That's in the way." But that's not the Zen mind. The Zen mind is an investigating mind. it says, okay, well, this is coming up. Where is this coming from? See, this is really like the Zen mind. Where is this coming from? And so the goal is like to understand what's happening, not to say yes or no to what's happening. And actually, you know, if you have pain in your legs, you can say, where is this pain coming from? I mean, the best thing is to just work with your breath and immerse yourself in your breath, and your pain will go away. But all the same, you know, where does pain come from? It's actually an interesting question. Where does anger come from? And so on and so on. In Bai Zhang's beautiful remarks, he says something so interesting. He said, and I didn't read it properly, but he said, even the Buddha had enemies. Isn't that interesting? I mean, the Buddha was supposed to be the embodiment of compassion. You know, he would spend his time with people who wasted his time. You know, people would come and he was the embodiment of loving kindness. Anybody who asked, he would try to help. And some people would listen to the Buddha's words and go away no wiser than when they came, right? Still caught in their own fantasies and so on. But apparently, absolutely patient, absolutely kind, generous, so on and so on. And yet even the Buddha had people who hated his guts. You know? There was a person whose name, Angulimala, I read it wrong, who tried to kill the Buddha. Actually, he was like a murderer. And the Buddha, in one of the sutras, tells him that, your fundamental nature is awakening, is enlightenment. And he's so stunned that he, like, weeps, you know. He can't believe it. And he becomes a monk and achieves enlightenment, a murderer, right? And Devadatta was the Buddha's cousin. The Buddha had, like, an evil cousin. And Devadatta wanted to be the Buddha. So he was a follower of the Buddha, but all the time he'd be looking at the Buddha thinking, they should be listening to me. You know, I should have that kind of respect. You know, I'm the one everybody should revere. He's just, you know, he's my cousin. He's an idiot. You know, I'm the one who's really... So he was plotting against the Buddha to have him assassinated. And the Buddha said to him, someday you will wake up and you will be enlightened. Right? So even the people who wanted to kill him, you know, he embraces that. So please think about this as you're practicing today. One more little story. There was a woman whose name was G.U. Kennett. G.U. Kennett. K-E-N-N-E-T-T. G.U. Kennett was a remarkable woman in England. She wanted to become an Anglican priest at a time when there were no women Anglican priests in England. And she was like a feminist. This is quite a long time ago. An early feminist. And she crusaded to be admitted to a seminary and to become an ordained priest. And she actually did it. She became the first, as far as I know, the first ordained woman priest in the Anglican Church of England. But then, you know, she was not happy with her life. She felt something was missing in her practice. And she read a book about Zen. and she went to Japan. Amazing, right? She was in the newspapers. She was the first ordained priest. And, you know, you would think she would sit back and say, okay, I've really achieved something, right? And she might sometimes say to herself, well, I have my doubts, or I have, you know, I'm not totally happy with my practice, but look, everybody respects me, everybody admires me, you know, I should be happy with this. But something was missing, so she left England and she went to study at a Zen temple in Japan. And there was a very progressive Roshi, a very progressive teacher, who let her study at his temple. But his students weren't progressive. Nobuko has just come back from Japan, and she has undoubtedly encountered what you could call a Japanese sexism. The Japanese have many wonderful qualities, but many Japanese don't believe in the equality of men and women. They don't. Even if they say they do, they really don't. You know. In this monastery, her presence as a woman was incredibly resented. And it was even worse because, of course, she was an English woman. It wasn't even Japanese. So the teacher there said to all the monks, I want you to welcome this person. I want you to make her happy and see her welcome, blah, blah, blah. And they all went, yes, of course. And then they did nothing of the kind. Basically when she would go to bed at night, a monk would say, don't worry, I'll come by. I'll knock on your door and wake you up. And of course, nobody would come by. So she'd wake up and everybody, she'd hear the sutras being chanted. And she'd have to run into the room late and feel like an idiot, right? People would say, okay, let me help you rake those leaves. And they'd say, here's how we rake the leaves. And she'd do what they say, and then it would turn out to be all wrong. And she'd get chewed out for doing it wrong. And people would hide things of hers and so on and so on. So she really was a person of indomitable spirit, you know, really indomitable spirit. But it really got to her, you know. I mean, it really got to her. You know, imagine being in a whole temple where nobody was your friend and everybody wanted you to fail, right? It'd be hard. Anyway, she went to see the teacher and in Doku-san, and she said, you know, I'm so beaten down. You know, everybody's unpleasant to me, unhelpful. He said, you must understand, everything is helping you to wake up. Everything is helping you to wake up. He said, even though these people think they're standing in your way, they're helping you too. So remember this, everything is helping you to wake up. Absolutely, 100%. So as you go through the day, you know, pain in your legs, fatigue, just remember this, everything is helping me to wake up. Everything is my true self. Everything is my true self. I think it is Daitokuji, but it could be Myoshinji, there's a fountain, a basin for water. And the characters are, I only know wholeness. And the character for wholeness is actually the character for feet. But it's I only know wholeness. Right? Feet is like feet solidly planted on the ground. That's wholeness. I only know wholeness. See, and if people wash their faces in that basin when it's freezing cold, you know, in the winter, there's no hot water in the temple. You wash your face, and it says, I only know wholeness. And in the summer, it's burning hot, you're covered with sweat, and you wash your face with this slimy, warm water. I only know wholeness. But it's not wishful thinking. Every time you break through, every time you embrace your obstacles, your world becomes bigger. And then it's like heaven. So today we all have obstacles. We're all working with them. Please go into deep mushin. Please go into your breath deeply. And when your discriminating mind disappears, your world will be bigger and everything will come to life. Okay? Everything is helping you to wake up, without exception. And the minute you say no, you're in your small mind and the world's broken into little pieces. So everybody's doing a beautiful job. Let it help you. Please let the pain in your legs help you. Let your fatigue help you. Okay? Let the heat help you.